Hello and welcome to Inside Property. I'm Richard Blanco. Are you a member of a landlord association? And if so, do you cherish your membership, use their helpline from time to time, and make full use of discounted services they offer? Do you think landlord associations are doing what they should to campaign for a better deal for landlords? Or do you see them getting into bed with government by helping to shape growing regulation? Maybe you prefer to get information and express yourself through other free-to-access online digital platforms, or indeed neither. How can these bodies attract more members, particularly so-called accidental landlords? And is it fair to expect them to provide a legitimate voice for the whole of the landlord community? Well, with me in the studio to discuss this are Richard Lambert, Chief Executive Officer of the National Landlords Association, Vanessa Warwick, who is landlord and co-founder of PropertyTribes.com, and Douglas Haig, who is Vice Chair of the Residential Landlords Association and Director for Wales. Now, let me come to you first, Douglas. I'm interested to hear from perhaps all of you, really, what you see as the purpose of a landlord association, what you're trying to achieve.
Well, I think primarily for us at the Residential Landlords Association, our primary purpose is to campaign and to represent our landlords, to understand what the issues that they are that they're facing on a day-to-day basis, understand the obstacles that they need to overcome, whether that's a legislative one or whether it's taxation or just general, you know, day-to-day problems that landlords might have. So to try and encapsulate that together and put that perspective and that viewpoint out to government or to local authorities or to the wider community at large. So, and then it's also to try and facilitate and provide advice and provide services to enable landlords to operate as cheaply and professionally as possible.
And Richard Lambert from the National Landlords Association, something similar, would you see that as the purpose as well?
Similar, but from a different perspective. Most trade associations start off as a group of like-minded businesses who want to try and make some kind of representation. But as they grow and evolve, they usually turn much more into business support networks. And that's really the emphasis that is from the National Landlords Association. I've run trade associations for the past 16 years. I've worked in trade associations for over 20 now. And fundamentally, the National Landlords Association is very like the other small business trade association I ran. Primarily, people join us for advice, information and guidance. That's what we're there to support them with. We then build on that by offering them additional services, training, discounts, so on and so forth. The stuff that really interests us, the national representation, the lobbying policy, for the most part, that is not why people join. And those people aren't really that interested in it until the moment when it directly and tangibly affects their business. And then they get very, very interested indeed.
Yes, and you're kind of talking about the last couple of years really there, aren't you? I think Richard
Lambert. No, I'm talking about the last 45 years since the NLA was founded by Lillian Klein, or it was the Small Landlords Association at that point in time. And it was founded because she wrote the Evening Standard protesting about the regulation around landlords at that point in time in the early 70s. And both the Evening Standard and then she herself were astonished by the sheer weight of the postbag she got back, because Lillian thought she was entirely on her own. And it was actually that weight of response that led her to form the Small Landlords Association at her kitchen table.
Well, it's great to hear the long view actually on that, because I, of course, was thinking about recent changes. And now, Vanessa, where does Property Tribes sit alongside the landlord associations? How would you relate to them? How do you see yourself comparing to them?
I don't really compare ourselves to them at all, actually. I think the landlords associations are very much needed, probably now more than ever, because of all the changes and challenges that we're seeing in the sector. Ultimately, I think the shared goal of the landlord associations and also property tribes is ultimately to make the private rented sector a better place for everybody. We share those common goals, I think. But in terms of what Property Tribes does, we are simply a discussion platform for landlords, and we're an information sharing portal for landlords. So it's very much like a barometer of what landlords have got on their minds, the pain that they're feeling, the problems that they need solving. And of course, ultimately, the landlord associations provide that additional support if they need it. But I think overall, we share that common goal that we can make the private rented sector a better place for everyone, because better, more informed, more engaged landlords means that tenants are going to have a better experience.
Now, Douglas, I'm interested to hear from you. Some landlords have argued that perhaps associations have been a bit too slow to evolve digitally, and therefore websites like Property Tribes have kind of filled in that gap. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, so the RLA, we're celebrating our 20th birthday this year, and we've always been a digital first organisation. So we don't tend to hold forum meetings or things like that. And when we very first launched, and it's not a dissimilar story to what Richard was talking about in terms of how the NLA formed. It was for the RLA, it was very much a group of landlords that wanted to campaign against the housing benefit being reduced for those under 60, and we campaigned against that as a group of landlords and managed to successfully overturn it through the next at the election. But and so the RLA was born out of that, but we realised that we didn't have the resources to go out there and try and be a national presence, so we tackled digital first, and in 1998 search engine optimization and all of these things was a very new concept if at all. I would argue that we certainly haven't neglected it. I think these other platforms are providing different spaces and fitting in niche areas. Some are trying to directly compete on some of the services or the information they provide. But I would say certainly things like Property Tribe are very complementary to what we're doing. And they're actually quite a good barometer of what landlords in the wider community are saying as well, ones that don't necessarily join our sort of organisation. So, yeah, if we're going to be honest, we could adapt quicker. We could invest more into our digital platforms and providing more services. But we've got to focus on what we're really there for, and that's the advice, support and campaigning.
And Richard, the NLA actually offers quite a lot of face-to-face contact for landlords, doesn't it, because of local meetings. Do you think they're as important as they always were? Or
I think for the people who attend them, they're very important. And I think it's important for us to be, as a national organisation, particularly one that's based in London, to be seen to be operating around the country and to have some kind of public face. I'm often told as I go around the country that you won't understand what it's like here because you're based in London, and that's a long way from everywhere else. Well, we often point out that we have those local meetings and local representatives in the areas around the country working on the ground and building up and maintaining that contact with local landlords. But we have to use all the channels that are available to us, and we have to be aware that we started before the digital age, and so we need to make sure that we can deal and relate to all our members. And sometimes that means working, if not at the speed of the slowest, then certainly at the speed of the slowest part of the convoy. Because if we moved all our services very rapidly in one direction and we found a large group that couldn't keep up, we would have a real difficulty. We'd lose members. I'll give you an example from my previous job at the British Woodworking Federation. When I joined in 2002, we had over 60 of the 400 odd members who hadn't yet moved to fax. So you have to always bear in mind where people are technologically before you make that big jump. It all looks very dramatic and exciting, particularly from your perspective as a provider. But you've got to think about your customer. You've got to think about your member. You've got to think about what they need from you and why they're paying you a subscription.
Now, all three organisations that are represented here today provide services to landlords. That's quite an important part of your business model in a sense as well, isn't it, Vanessa?
Property Tribes itself doesn't provide any services other than providing the platform, but we do have an advertising and sponsorship model, because our dream has always been to have a space that's free to use. We didn't want to put up any barriers to entry, like any kind of membership subscription type situation. So we've been able to support the site as a free-to-use community resource by working with partners and sponsors, such as the Residential Landlords Association, who are one of our partners. And it's interesting, because I think we could almost be a funnel into the Landlord Association awareness and memberships, because we have a lot of landlords or wannabe landlords coming to us when they're in the research phase of their, their pre-acquisition kind of research phase. And we can introduce them to the concept of being a member of a landlord association. And we recommend that to our members that they join more than one landlord association, because as we're already hearing in this broadcast, the associations have different flavours, and they both offer different things, and they're very inexpensive to join. I'd draw a metaphor to motorhoming, which my husband and I are big fans of, but we're members of the Caravan and Motorhome Club, and we're also members of the Caravan and Camping Club, because they both offer slightly different things, and we want to take advantage of what each one offers. So I think property tribes can be a big part of creating awareness that the associations exist and the benefits of joining them. And I think we've already touched on that landlords tend to work in isolation or have felt isolated in the past. Now there's no reason for them to, because there are the associations that are putting on training and local networking events and bigger conferences, and there are sites like Property Tribes where they can also congregate. And it's great that landlords have so much choice. I think it's very positive.
Douglas, which services do you find are most in demand that the RLA offers or partners with?
Without a doubt, the service that people contact us for initially is usually the landlord advice team. So we've got a team of guys and gals that answer the phones and give some absolutely superb advice to our landlords at times when they're pretty distressed. I think the guys are sort of acting almost like a counselling role in some occasions, because and I would say that they are a real catalyst for a lot of people joining our organisation as well. So you're getting to the point where most landlords are fairly fortunate in that they've got good tenants and they're paying on time. But then unfortunately that time comes when somebody stops paying their rent, stops responding to the landlord, doesn't engage. And then they realise actually how difficult the law can be in terms of in that process. And that's very often when they might search around on forums and then eventually go, well, actually, if I pay $79.95 or whatever is the membership fee is now, I can speak to somebody right now. And we've recently also launched our online chat facility, and that's been phenomenally well received. I was skeptical of it initially, but it means we've extended our hours that people can answer questions for or have their questions answered, and the volume of inquiries has gone up considerably as well.
And Richard, I would imagine the advice line is probably one of the most used services at the NLA as well.
Absolutely, we answered over 40,000 calls last year, and it's probably the service that most people look for, most people promotes most people to join.
And there are a range of other services, aren't there, like insurance and mortgages. Can you tell us about some of the other services that are offered?
So we offer a range of other services in terms of what we tried to do was set ourselves up as the one-stop shop for landlords. So whatever you needed, you could find it if you came to the NLA website. So we have a partnership with an insurance provider, mortgage provider, tenant check provider, virtually any aspect of the landlording business you can think of that we could help with, and that we've found that we can get a good deal for the members, we've arranged that kind of partnership. Not always the cheapest, but you've got the assurance of quality because we've checked the provider, and so we have that services. We've built up our training offer over the last few years, so we're increasingly training an increasing number of people, increasing range of training courses, and we have partnerships with a whole group of recognised suppliers, businesses who want to have a relationship with us, and through us, a relationship with our members.
One of the criticisms I hear sometimes, Richard, is that landlords feel that the balance between service provision and campaigning is a bit skewed towards providing services, and people start to feel like the landlord associations are kind of marketing machines. And and what do you say to that criticism?
Let's take the last year. If we hadn't got the commercial income from the commercial services, we would need to have recruited 11,000 more members to sustain the organisation at the level it was at, and we would need to do that every single year. The fact is that we can do a certain amount of things on the subscription income that we receive, but to do more, we need more income from more sources. The other thing is the reason trade associations branched out into providing these kind of additional services is because actually the most vulnerable part of your income is your membership subscription income. And having worked in the construction sector during the last recession, the subscription income was the income that was the element of the income that was hit most hard, and we lost something like 12% of our income in my trade association over 3 years for withdrawing subscriptions because of people going out of business or people simply saying, I can't afford to pay that anymore. So the commercial services is actually a much steadier flow of income.
Do you think you've got the balance right at the RLA, Douglas, as well, around between providing services and campaigning?
I think in general, and Richard may disagree with this, but in general, we are more campaign focused. We do push that out a lot more. For instance, we've set up a semi-independent research establishment now called Pearl. Don't ask me what it stands for, but the idea is there to try and change the rhetoric around the discussions of the private rented sector to make sure that the opinion out there is based on fact as opposed to just emotion. So we've invested a lot of that, and we're bringing forward research papers. We probably invest something like 22-23% of our entire income into policy and campaigning work, which is a significant proportion, and then it's balancing out what the services are going to look like. We monitor all of our services very, very carefully to try and both in terms of finding out what the appetite is, the profitability, whether they're actually providing good value for money. As Richard has said, you put a lot. Somebody doesn't just walk through the door at the RLA and say, "I want to start doing your EPCs or doing energy efficiency improvements for you." There is a process under which we check it. We can compare it against the market and make sure it is the right offering for our landlords. And ultimately, if they're not the right partner or the service isn't required, we look at either how we're marketing that or say, well, is it actually a service that we need at all?
Vanessa, we see the RLA and the NLA in the press a lot, commenting on, you know, government proposals, etc. Do you see them as the legitimate voice of the landlord community?
I certainly do, yes. I think that they're very, very important in the work that they do in that respect. You know, they are attending Treasury meetings. They're interacting at a senior level with politicians. You know, the fact is that the more membership that they have, the greater the voice will obviously be. There is strength in numbers. But I think, you know, what we're all fighting against is an age-old problem that the small landlord actually doesn't understand that they're a landlord. They are a vet or a teacher or, you know, a solicitor. They have their busy career and they've got a few buy-to-lets on the side. And their head isn't in landlord mode. And this small kind of landlord actually does make up the mass market. I mean, we've recently heard this week that there are now 2.5 million landlords in the UK, and approximately 97% of those are what you would categorise as the small landlord with three properties or less. And they're just not in landlord mode. They're perhaps even not aware that they could join a landlord association. They may never heard of Section 24, which is very worrying for them. So, you know, we're all fighting against this lack of awareness through the small landlord, which is the small landlord, which is indeed the mass market. And I just wanted to pick up on the previous point that all of the organisations here today, we are professional ecosystems for landlords. And I think that's a very healthy thing for a landlord to become part of, because large parts of the sector are unregulated or have unscrupulous operators. And I think coming into a professional ecosystem like the RLA, the NLA, or indeed property tribes, they are exposed to trusted products and services that are vetted before they're put out to the network. So I think that's a very important thing and benefit of being part of such an ecosystem.
Well, we'd love to hear our listeners' views, of course, on landlord associations. So do let us know via the website, which is insideproperty.org.uk. And you can also review the programme on Audioboom and iTunes. Well, you're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco. We're looking at the work of landlord associations with my guests, Douglas Haig, Vice Chair of the Residential Landlords Association and Director for Wales, Vanessa Warwick, who is a landlord and co-founder of PropertyTribes.com, and Richard Lambert, who is Chief Executive Officer of the National Landlords Association. Now, Richard, if we're to go by Vanessa's figures there on the number of landlords, 2.5 million, which is the first time I've heard that one, actually, because I usually think of it as of around 2 million. That probably means that membership of landlord associations really is only about 5%, maybe 10% tops of the number of landlords out there. How do you get more landlords, particularly these hard to reach accidental landlords, to become members of associations?
That's the eternal question for us, and indeed for any trade association, is how do you get the unengaged? I think the landlord, as Vanessa says, because most landlords are not thinking of themselves as landlords, they're thinking of those other things, because they're not, they don't congregate in one area, they don't read one particular magazine or one particular newspaper or watch one particular TV channel, it is a real challenge about how you find where they are to promote yourself to them. And I think that's the conundrum with which we're probably all struggling at one level or another. We believe that if we can find a way of getting in front of those unengaged landlords, we have something which will persuade people to that it's worth having. But it's finding them first.
Yes, and Douglas, this is a challenge in a way when landlords' associations are talking to government about policy. I mean, you know, they could argue that you don't really represent enough landlords, you know, to carry as much weight as you could.
Yeah, and it's been a point that's been waged at us by certain government officials when they don't necessarily want to listen to what we're saying at the time, heaven forbid. As Richard says, if we can solve this problem, then you know, we'd be in a very different position. But we're not talking about the one group of people that wants the same thing, that does the same thing. So identifying them is going to be a very, very difficult thing to do. And ultimately, it's the same situation with that government has in terms of regulating the sector as well. So if we need to target them with different services and identify and getting them to recognise that they're landlords as well, we had the problem with RentSmart Wales registration scheme in Wales when that came in year before last. And one of the things there was you could put a billboard outside a landlord's house saying, Mr. Landlord, please read this. And they just wouldn't recognise it because they don't identify themselves as a landlord.
And I think that's part of the problem, is that landlords are not a homogeneous grouping. Actually, once you start to get into the sheer range and breadth and depth and the different kinds of people who are landlords, different kinds of property they're in, the different reasons they're in, involved, the different tenants they're looking at, it's a much more complicated picture. And you know, we've heard a lot of talk recently about how you use data to build profiles. But you know, building data from just kind of working out what kind of profiles you're looking for, the more you look, the more complex it becomes, because there is this great myriad and web of landlords, landlord types.
Vanessa, do you think it's of value to have this sort of diversity of landlord associations, or would it be better if they all merged and kind of provided one bigger voice?
It's an interesting question. I'm really in favour of the diversity. I think that they can focus on different areas and have different strengths. You know, it's important that people have choice as well. It is a bit of a tricky question, really, but we've always been of the view at Property Tribes that that choice is good, and that people can go and dip in and out of different things and take from each thing what's relevant to them. And I think, you know, the recent tenant tax campaign against Section 24 was a prime example of when everybody came together under one cause, agendas were put to one side, and everybody worked for the greater good of the landlord community. And I would like to see more of that happening, and indeed more of the other bodies within the sector also joining into those kind of campaigns and lending their support. So overall, I think it is good that there's choice. There's obviously regional landlord associations as well. Also, local authorities put on free landlord get-togethers and evenings, so they're all a great resource for the community. And certainly at Property Tribes, the way we've tackled trying to reach out to this hard to grab landlord is that we've really focused on the fact that when everything's going well in their landlord life, they don't even think about anything to do with their properties, their tenants, they're on the back burner, everything's fine. This demographic of landlord only gets into, you know, into a landlord's mindset when actually something goes wrong, when the tenant stops paying the rent or there's a problem. And on that basis, they're in kind of cure mode, which of course we all know in property is a lot more expensive and emotional heartache, etc. So what we've tried to do at Property Tribes is create resources that do provide solutions for landlords, but also move them into prevention mode, in other words, education. So if you've had this problem, okay, here's the solution, but this is what you need to do in future to stop having this problem again so it doesn't arise. So that's certainly been our tactic for gaining landlord eyeballs onto our community, and we're currently ranked around the 7,000th busiest website in the UK, which is good for a niche topic. So I think that's a way to reach out to try and provide these resources for landlords when they're in distress or in pain mode, and then kind of nurture them on from there.
When Patrick Collinson came on the show, he's money editor from The Guardian, he said he was appalled by the level of whinging and complaining that he saw on landlord property websites, particularly about things like increases in taxes and so on. And his view was that, you know, there was just a lot of unnecessary ranting going on.
Really?
Yes.
I don't know. I think we see... we see landlords sharing their concerns. We see, you know, just sharing something benefits the sharer and the people that are supporting them and the people that are reading what's going on. So I wouldn't say I see a great deal of rants. I see landlords in pain. I see landlords uncertain about the future. One thing landlords hate is uncertainty. Because clearly, you know, when you're into a buy-to-let property on that basis, you're probably going to be in a relationship with that property for maybe 20 to 25 years, and uncertainty, you know, does put landlords off. It deters them, and I think we are seeing a lot of that at the moment.
Douglas, when landlords are at their grumpiest, and you know, I often see grumpy landlords, sometimes I'm one myself, but when I'm out and about at meetings, they complain that, you know, what were landlord associations doing when the Section 24 tax changes came in? Why haven't they done more to stop the changes to buy-to-let regulation, which now mean that in many cases landlords are struggling to get more than 60% loan-to-value loans, and a lot of lenders are now not lending to portfolio landlords, and some of them say they really feel let down by the landlord associations.
I get that. I do. And I accept that we could always do more. We could always work harder. But there is a certain amount of resource that we have. And we, as you've already pointed out, in terms of the membership numbers, it's you. People need, if they're feeling aggrieved about a subject, get behind and get involved in a campaign and lend your support, either in terms of your voice or your work ethic or your membership fee to allow us to do it on your behalf. But it's a very difficult thing for us to fully put out there exactly what is happening behind the scenes. So especially the landlord associations, that we are looking at what the political climate is and what the sentiment is, and therefore we're trying to predict ourselves where the direction of regulation is going. And we're going through, you know, we've gone through one change, which was Osborne saying we need more money, and that's resulted in these the targeting landlords, because, you know, in terms of votes, people aren't going to be complaining too much that landlords are being taxed more, and it helps them raise more money. So we've gone through that finance section. We're now looking at a change in terms of a battle of the two parties, and it's been identified that there are in excess of 9 million renters out there who traditionally have not voted in the past. And so they're being targeted and saying, well, actually, you can't get on the housing ladder until you're in your either the late 30s or early 40s nowadays. And so that's being tapped into. And whereas, so you're seeing the Conservative Party, which you might have traditionally seen as a safe haven for the landlord, actually bringing policies which are not necessarily as landlord friendly as we might think. So landlord associations are targeting those areas. They're looking at those areas. They're trying to head some of those things off at the pass. And some of the things we've actually stopped ever hitting the headlines, but some of that's done behind closed doors. So it's a very hard thing to explain exactly what you're doing all the time.
And some of this comes back to politics being the art of the possible. And sometimes it is very difficult to get across to your local, ordinary landlord members quite what you've done is what was possible. So, for example, if we take the PRA changes, and there have been a lot of angst about that, we could not lobby against the fact that there was a global recession. We could not lobby against the fact that lending policies across the globe had taken advantage of that, had been struck by that, and that some of the practices before had been, frankly, really risky. We could not lobby against the fact that the governor of the Bank of England was talking to the governor of the European Bank, who was talking to the governor of the Fed, and they were all saying something has to be done about this. So there was going to be tighter regulation. If you think back to what was originally proposed under the Mortgage Market Review, it was full regulation of buy-to-let in the same way that consumer mortgages are regulated, which would cost a lot more and would provide a lot more weight on compliance weight. What we did, we lobbied in Europe around the mortgage directive. We lobbied the Bank of England, the Treasury around transposition. We lobbied the Bank of England, the power and the PRA. What we've got is considerably less than what might have happened if we'd simply been faced with full consumer regulation of buy-to-let. But sometimes the choice is being royally shafted and being slightly shafted. So I would argue that in the end, yes, you may still be shafted, but it's not nearly as bad as it could have been. And that is something which the landlord associations in numerous policy areas have actually achieved. It might have been bad. It might not be what you want. You might think it's bad. It could have been a whole lot worse if we hadn't put our effort into it.
Vanessa, do you think that landlord associations do enough to counter all this negativity about landlords that demonises us in the media?
It's a tricky one because those minds won't be changed, whatever you say. I think that we all have to lead by example. We have to show that we want to create a better private rented sector, and that we share best practice, and that we celebrate good landlords and positive stories about landlords. And certainly on Property Tribes, there's some incredible threads about landlords that have assisted tenants through very challenging times, helped them get back on track, get their lives back into a better position, and so on. I always cite the example of there was a programme called Britain's Worst Teeth. If it was called Britain's Best Teeth, nobody would have watched it. The media generates attention through very emotive topics, and prime example is the recent film by the Labour Party that came out this week, and it's all about really just generating attention and eyeballs for a message to be sold off the back of it. And whatever we do, there is going to be this anti-landlord sentiment. We've been put up there as public number one enemy, along with estate agents and bankers. We're allegedly this greedy bunch of people that are taking advantage of others. And those minds won't be changed. So all I certainly try and do in my landlord world is just behave in an ethical and professional manner towards my tenants, try and create a good experience for them, and obviously share those views via sites like Property Tribes.
Douglas, landlord associations are just not doing enough to change the narrative and get people to see the PRS and landlords more positively.
I would disagree with that as a blanket statement, but we could do more. I've admitted that, but there is something that we need to do in terms of we have to all come to an acceptance that the market needs to mature. We are not, as a landlord association, I'm not sitting here and I'm not saying that I am here to represent every landlord, because I'm certainly not. There's a section of that market I want to no longer be a landlord. I want them out of the market and I want to eradicate them entirely. There's a section that are our members that are doing a fantastic job, and there's a section that need to learn more about how to be a landlord properly, and we want to bring them along on that journey. But we do have to accept that standards are improving, that we need to treat the tenant more as a customer. They are our customer. And that narrative can be sometimes very difficult to bring people along for the journey. But it's about doing it at the right pace. It's about doing it in the right way, avoiding bureaucracy and making sure that any changes that do come into effect are really for the benefit of the sector and not just some token gesture that creates a registration scheme or a new licensing scheme, and then the local councillors can go away and say we've done something about those nasty landlords, which is what is happening, and this is our concern about the direction politics is going at the moment.
Well, I wanted to come on to this issue of increased regulation. Douglas mentioned Rent Smart Wales, where landlords must register, and also it's mandatory that you are accredited if you're going to manage a property. Do you see any opportunities here, Richard, perhaps in England, where the vast majority of landlords are in the UK? I mean, particularly now we're seeing agents will have to sign up to a code of practice. What opportunities might there be for landlord associations?
It rather depends what form that regulation takes. I mean, we're at the NLA, we are very clear. We are not a regulator. We are a representative organisation, and we don't want to get involved in regulation. We don't think our members want us to get involved in regulation. They think we should be representing their interests to the regulators. On the one hand, I could say, as a trade association chief executive, if every landlord was told you have to join a trade body, fantastic. That would solve our problem at trying to find where all that mass of unengaged landlords are. Although every mandated registration scheme I've ever heard of has the problem with finding that last rump of landlords. On the other hand, if that was set up in some part, if that was government mandated, if the government would decide to set up some kind of national regulator, well, I can see that if every landlord had to register with a national body, there would be political pressure. There would certainly be pressure from the housing lobby and the local authorities to say, well, that national body should be funneling advice, information, guidance, education to those landlords, should probably have some kind of standard for those landlords. Well, you start to then wonder, what are we there for? Particularly, what are we going to offer that would persuade landlords to part with their money to continue to fund us? So I see a lot more challenges around mandated membership of an organisation rather than opportunities.
Hmm. And how do you think landlords might see this, Vanessa, if, in England, registration and accreditation became compulsory and perhaps that meant compulsory membership of a trade body?
It's hard to say. I mean, just with my landlord hat on, the biggest issue for me is that there's not enough enforcement of existing legislation, because there's actually, local authorities have plenty of powers at their fingertips to drive out rogues. And, when we talk about rogue landlords, they are the minority. The vast majority of the 2.5 million landlords that are supposedly in the UK are just decent, hardworking people that have invested in property for a pension or a legacy for their children, whatever it may be. They want to provide a good service. OK, they may need educating a little bit because ignorance is never an excuse. And that's where a lot of the organisations here come into play, to assist them in being better landlords, as I mentioned earlier. But ultimately, Labour wouldn't be able to include a cockroach-infested HMO in their film if the local authority had dealt with that landlord. So, before we go around tweaking more levers and introducing more red tape, I think we really need to look at the existing legislation being used a lot more to drive out the rogue sector, because ultimately these rogues, they're not going to conform to anything. They're always going to skate under the radar. Even if they were mandated to join a landlord association, they probably wouldn't. They are the rogue element that causes all the problems for the decent and ethical landlords. And I would certainly like to see local authorities coming down a lot harder on the rogue element and using their extensive powers.
Well, let me ask Douglas and Richard finally about what you see as the future role of associations and how that might pan out in the next few years. Douglas, why don't you start us off?
Well, it's obviously something that we're considering as the RLA. What is the future? We've got a lot of political challenges on our on our doorstep right now, and you know, if party changed, then we could have even more. So as they decide to make a change in direction, there's going to be impacts of the finance changes, and is that going to impact how landlords invest? Are they going to divest? Are they going to incorporate? We're trying to see what these impacts are. We've obviously done what our future predictions are, and now we're doing regular surveys to see what's actually happening going forward. So then we've got to understand, well, is the membership model something that we continue with in the long term? Is that the right way to go? We see other platforms, other technologies, other services that are coming out and bolting on advice on the back end of that. But ultimately, those platforms are almost never providing the representation and the campaigning behind it. And I think that's what some landlords need to be aware of when they are joining some other organisation for those other services. It's a lot of challenges. A lot of challenges. We're talking to a lot of people and we're experimenting with some different ideas right now. So I think you will see certainly the RLA evolving as an organisation, and you've referred to the digital. Are we keeping up with that in the pace that we should? In some areas we haven't. In some areas I think we've led it. But as Richard quite rightly pointed out, average age of landlord is in our membership is about 55 years old. Not all of them want to. I mean, the landlord I see on a regular basis, he's 93. And I think Vanessa met him, Harry, once. He's a hell of a character. But he's not going to go online and adopt all those services. So we've got to be very, very careful about bringing on along our membership as to whatever we do, because we've got a lot of members now. And they obviously like what we do. But also, how do we tap into that new generation of landlords, especially when they're investing in different ways that is untraditional?
The future role of landlord associations, Richard?
The future role of the landlord associations will be to serve the members. The market and the membership are going to evolve, and we have to think about, we have to be aware of what they want, what they need, and how we can work to serve them. If I jump back to 2000, when everyone was talking about resolving the Y2K bug, I was working at the British Property Federation then, and I was told regularly, your organisation and organisations like yours will be irrelevant in 2 years' time, because once people resolve the Y2K bug, more people will be on the internet, more people will use email, government is putting all that information out there, they won't need you to be the interlocutor between them and government, they won't need to pay you to tell them what government is doing, because they can go and find it out themselves. Well, actually, what happened was we realised we had to find some way of adding value to that simple information, to explain it, to help people understand it, help people work with it. So we adapted, we evolved, we found a way. And I think that will continue. Trade bodies go back to the Middle Ages, but you have to evolve and you have to understand what people need from you at the time. If you can't do that, then you don't deserve to continue.
Okay, well, on that note, that's it for this programme. My thanks to my guests, Vanessa Warwick, Richard Lambert and Douglas Haig, and to you for listening. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the programme. Maybe you'd like to leave a review on Audioboom or iTunes, as I've mentioned. And would you be interested in joining a listeners' panel? If so, please do get in touch via the website, which is insideproperty.org.uk.